Well, good morning to everyone. I think it's about time. In this topic of leadership, how many of you are new today? We're not here yesterday. Yeah, so let me share a little bit about yesterday to kind of catch you up, because we were halfway through six ideas, and three of them kind of came out yesterday. Three will come out today. The context of this, as I shared yesterday, was one where one thinks about topics. At Pepperdine, you have to submit them months before you get here, and then try to make sure they're relevant if you can think of something to say on the topic you suggested months ago. And so this is a little bit generic, but the idea was to think a little bit about leadership, and it really comes from a perspective of my work leading a university, which requires a little bit of that. Our work each year training some of the top executives in the state of Tennessee and speaking each year right before the governor, so you got something to say. And then thinking about the reality of our church community and churches to think about leadership and to offer that, because the world make them slightly more memorable by just sharing an illustration that might lead to track the iceberg. And that was really based on the story of Admiral Byrd and the reality that as he was searching for the North Pole, there was a moment in time where they would work all day to get further north and then measure where they were that night and find they were farther away from what they were trying to get to. And the challenge there finally became obvious. They were on a large iceberg, and it was actually says, we've got to understand and be quite straightforward about our context. If we're going to lead, we've got to know what we're leading and how we're leading it in the context that we're leading. One was to ask, why not? That really came from a quote that was used at Robert Kennedy's funeral. And ask why not. And leaders today, I think, leaders always, but leaders have to have a sense of vision. They have to be able to say, you know, here's my 100-person congregation, what's my vision? Here's my university in Nashville, what's my vision? Here's this ministry, what's the vision? I know what is, I live in that all day, every day. But how do I get beyond that? And I confessed a little bit that while I think we can teach people a whole set of skills, ...15 weeks in the class and come out of that and say, ah, now you're all visionaries. I mean, there's something about that that's a little bit more inherent, and frankly, very, very few people have it. But I think the other side of that, or the flip side, is true as well. We need to think about how communication becomes extraordinarily significant in moments that are really critical moments. And I shared two or three stories yesterday about memorable forever. Not an easy thing to sort that one out, but again, as we're leading a church or we're working in the community, leading an organization, that conversation is going to be significant. Well, let's move on today. Let me share with you the three things we're going to talk about. One is we're going to talk about leaders being make those real with some stories in just a couple of moments. Piece about leadership that is absolutely profound. And up here, all the characteristics of a leader. You would come up with a whole lot of words. You'd come up with words like decisive. You'd come up with words like, those are all attributes that leaders at various times have to have. But there's another list. And there's another list of those people who are leading others and influencing others that has words on it that just don't seem to fit. So of those individuals kind of walking into the distance. And then if you look at the shadow, every one of them in the shadow has a cane or a crutch. And somebody did a good job of that book jacket, didn't they? And so here is the confident profile of this leader walking forward, and it's only in the shadow that you see the crutch, or you see I intervened in churches when I worked here for the Strauss Institute. To want to expose anything that's kind of less than perfect. I'm in charge of these folks. I have to make the decisions. We meet on Thursday nights. You know, they're going to follow me if I'm a strong leader. On it goes. And yet, I started, instead of dealing with kind of the conflicts that were in front of them, tell me about your kids. They say, well, you don't want to know about my kids, or that's not relevant. Tremendous disappointment. Tremendous hurt. Something that hadn't gone exactly. Part of it with me anymore. And so now I either I'm going to defend this one to my kids, which means all those things I said over here aren't going to stand quite the same way. Horrible place. But I ask, tell me about your kids. And in there, we all will recognize that if you live life long enough, there's just a lot of bad moments. There's a lot of moments of disappointment. There's a lot of... Now think about the Apostle Paul. We talked about him yesterday and talked about his leadership. You know, the first thing he did is to communicate not what divided them or separated them, but what united them. He says, but I see you're really religious. And then he says, here, over here, this is an idol to an unknown God. Let's talk about that one. Wise in his communication. Wise in what he wanted to take on at what time. Wise in then getting to tell them the story of what to them was an unknown God, what to him was the known God. But you'll notice in Corinthians, when he writes to the church there, mm-hmm. he talks about his own affliction. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And he talks about it being a thorn in the flesh. And I love reading all the theologians that try to figure that out, because nobody has, right? Nobody's figured it out, but they all have lots and lots of theories. And he helps us understand that there was a reason, and he attributes it to Satan, that he attributes the larger picture to God, in the sense that that thorn was there, and God allowed it to be there to keep him humble. So he's got this affliction, this weakness. He tries to get rid of it. That doesn't happen. And he finally says, yeah, but this is saying, and I think the statement is the right statement. He says, so why don't we get real? Why don't we in churches get real? Because if in fact God works that way, or he works that way with Paul, we could be a lot freer in people will think a whole lot more of us than the other way. And it's counterintuitive, because we have this little voice in us that says, you know, be strong. They're really looking for something that are the opposite characteristics, but we have such a hard time realizing that. So think with me for a couple of moments about that idea. And it's the idea that says, how do we lead with a limp? How do we recognize and not be ashamed of the cane or the crutch as we're trying to lead? I work with young people. I work with those who are 18 to 22 years old, and there are thousands of them on our campus, and they are a generation that is looking really, really hard or 20 years old, right? But they see the world out there, and they're exposed to that world, you know, hundreds of times a day as they're on their iPads or their iPhones. There are the chapel, you know, the reality is I'd like to be the president, and I'd like for them to understand, you know, the importance of the office, and I'd like them to understand the history of 17 of us at the university, and I could go on and on and on about stuff they couldn't care less about. They want to know if I'm real. And so, if I tell them, oh, we've got this new, they don't care. But when I tell a story about they are absolutely mesmerized. How could the president be talking about that? How could I talk about my batting average when I was in Little League? I talk about that often because we're a Division I school. We play athletics at a fairly high level, and yet the president of that university that leads that, well, my batting average when I was in Little League was .000. And my batting average, I never got a hit in my entire career. Never. And they sit there and listen to me tell that story, and they can't believe it. I mean, how could somebody never, ever get a hit? Here he is. Now, a couple of
and exciting and impressive than that. But it isn't.
We have students who have to pass exams and to get out of school in a whole lot of different fields, and so I share with them. They'd be very proud. It was an awful, awful, awful moment in my life. I failed the bar exam before Pepperdine invited me to come teach. Is there are moments in life, and if we're honest about it, most of them have them, most of us have them, they're moments of weakness, and in fact, in leadership, they're the very, very moments that somehow make this seem so real. Let me read to you just the jacket of this book, just two paragraphs here, but listen closely because I think it is summed up so very, very well. Forget everything you... Confidence, charisma count for little over the long haul. Or in spite of their weakness, they lead with the power because of their weakness. So there's something there that's just counterintuitive, and I think it would be awfully healthy for us to think about that, especially in the context of church. I remember being an elder and the conversations we would have, and one of them that was so freeing is a reminder to the congregation, you know, we'll quit any time. It's not a problem. You know, this is not something I have to hold on to for the next 32 years. I'll step any time. You got somebody else, that's just fine. And, of course, the more you're willing to step out, what happens? The more they... have these moments where they expect the elders agree. Well, what if we don't? And say, we elders are in the same chaos the rest of you are in. The only with you another idea, this would be, I guess, number five, and that would be confident leaders go outside the wire. Anybody have any idea what I'm talking about there? Pardon what? You're close. You're close.
Great Escape.
Great Escape, okay. The Wire, you're exactly right. That's a reference to a bunker in a moment of battle or warfare. And I guess, folks, my... The Wire... If you're inside the wire, you're inside the bunker, you've got sandbags around you, the artillery or whatever is there with you, there's a sense of safety there. If you go outside the wire, all of a sudden you're extraordinarily vulnerable. And now I want you to think about that for a moment. I want you especially to think about our church community, and we'll get to that in just a couple seconds. Someone has said, a ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships are for. The ship in the harbor is very, very safe, but that's not what ships are for. Ships are to go out into the ocean and to catch fish or deliver products or whatever it might be. That's what ships are for, to manufacture ships and just keep them in the harbor so they're safe. Probably doesn't accomplish very much. And of our being somewhat isolated and happy and enjoying this moment. We got to leave all. We get a response to it from people who aren't comfortable doing it. And danger there. But again, Jesus said, go into all the world. He didn't say find a little church somewhere and be happy for the next 30 years. And so there is some sense of that engagement, and that requires, I think, a certain level of leadership. And so I want you to think for a moment, you know, this is not back where we normally are. We're dealing with people we don't normally deal with. This is messy. That's outside the wire. Nashville very well. Don't know David Lipscomb very well, but he was kind of an interesting guy. He was not an easy one to pigeonhole. He did some things during his life that back then were radical and would be radical today. There's this cholera epidemic that goes through Nashville, and it was something where they had no idea what to do because there was really no cure. And so what happened is the rich folks in Nashville actually paid to bring trains in to get them out of town. And so those who could leave town could pay enough, they'd leave town, and eventually the epidemic would sweep. And now you've got to understand this scene because it is so different than we might expect. So here's David Lipscomb on his farm, which is now our campus. He wears this kind of wide-brimmed flat hat. He's got these little tiny glasses on. He's got this kind of scruffy. To a convent, picks up nuns from the convent. Thing they know how to do, and that's clean people's houses. That's all they know how to do. And now think about that ecumenical scene, if you will, for to leave the safety of our own homes, to expose ourselves to the disease, and we're called to do that with other people who are also called to do that. And so you have David Lipscomb there in the wagon, and these nuns. I shared the story one time. There was a priest in the audience. And I made the comment, I said, I don't know if the nuns were in their habits or not. It's the turn of the century. And so imagine them with their nunnery on, and they're in this wagon, and they're on their way. And, of course, what happened, one might expect, David Lipscomb ended up catching cholera. And in some sense, never really recovered from that. So there's something there about leaders. Danger may in fact affect us. But that's what Jesus did. That's what all the disciples did. That's what the Apostle Paul did. They're all out there in the world, not back somewhere that is particularly safe. So I tell our students, I say, the city is our campus and the world is our classroom. And I want them to get a mindset that you don't, even though it's the safest campus in all of Middle Tennessee, the reality is you don't come to this university to be on the campus. You come to the university for that experience to happen. And so when I came, we were fairly isolated. And fairly comfortable with that, like a lot of your churches. But it's different. So the impact students have on their community.
We send about 800 students and faculty on mission trips every year to 25 different countries, and every one of those is outside the wire. The nervous and security service that can evacuate them from anywhere in the world, because we know there's danger. But you know, the students are amazing. They get this, you know. You beat them coming home at the airport, and you think they'd be absolutely exhausted, right? They've been away for 10 days. They've been digging this, building that. They're bouncing off the walls. Off that plane, because there's something so invigorating about being outside the wire that you're never going to capture inside the wire.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be neat if our church folks understood that? But at times, it's really, really difficult.
One of the calls I got, we have about 200,000 visitors a year on the Lipscomb campus, trying to be very hospitable to the community. And so I get a call one day from, Walt got the call, from an organization called Nashville Cares. And Nashville Cares called, and they said, you know, we're Nashville Cares, a nonprofit here in Nashville, and what we'd like to do, if you'd be so gracious to us, is we'd like to have our annual fundraising breakfast in Allen Arena on the Lipscomb campus. Now, I don't know why they decided that. But Nashville Cares is an organization and a large part of that population will be folks who have a sexual identity. I mean, what's the message to the community when this year's widely publicized fundraising breakfast for that word is out, and you're the one sponsoring. I mean, how do you make that? Well, that's one way to do it. But our board has this, and your church could do. Which we make decisions before we have the decisions to make. Mm-hmm. We want to be Christian intentionally, courageous. Courageously, and we want to be Christian gracious. So if you got the call, we're Nashville Cares. We'd love to have our annual fundraising event on your campus, and you had that lens to look through to raise money for the good they're doing in the lives of people. Now, can I fix every piece of that? Can I go back and adjust this and that? I just have to get ready for the letters. But frankly, I don't care. About being beyond the wire that I think has great power. And so it seems to me that the question becomes, you know, what's happening in your church? And that is, confident leaders, I think, care in the shadows. And I want you to not get hung up on this too much. I don't want you to think that what's in the shadows is And I think this is another paradox of leadership. You know, we think the leader is a public figure. We think it's probably true in some moments. But there's a dimension of leadership that's in the shadows. And yet, ironically, again, it may be the most powerful work you ever. Far powerful, more powerful than, you know, making that tremendous speech in front of the congregation. More powerful than the public events we have are these moments where, if you are sensitive to them, you are invited into the intimate lives of people in a way. All of a sudden, you have a level of credibility that you never would otherwise have. I learned this early on in my tenure, and I really didn't learn it because I expected to learn it. I had a professor whose mother died in Alabama, and all the funerals of parents of our faculty or children of our faculty, I mean, the immediate family, if someone died, I kind of wanted to try to be there. Now, I learned funerals in Tennessee are a different thing than California, you know. So I learned very quickly, there's no way I could do that. There's no way the president could show up. Professor's mother died in Alabama, and it was only a couple hours away, so that was closer. And so I decided I'd drive down to her funeral. And drove down to a small town in Alabama, and I get there. It's a small white Church of Christ. She'd probably been a member for 50 years. She'd been a school teacher in this town. And so I walked in, and I greeted the professor who lost his mother and sat down and listened. Did the funeral and then got in my car and drove back home. Where that professor was introducing me. And he was introducing me to some at the resume kind of stuff, right? You know, Dr. Lowry, he spent, you know, 17 years at Pepperdine doing this. Go through it anyway because they feel like they have to. Well, he gets up there and ignores it all. He talks about the day in Alabama where I showed up at his mother's funeral. He said, I was at a small church, I was there, my mother had died, she was so this old. And he said, I looked to the back of that little church and in the sunlight coming in the my entire relationship is defined not because of all the highfalutin academic stuff we do together, but it's all defined because I showed up at his mother's funeral. And I think, you know, I learned in these moments of intimacy, many times kind of acute need.
ever forget it.
We had a faculty member one time who lost a child, and Ron and I flew to the city, and we stayed 5 days in a hotel, and we saw the folks. You call when you need to, but we're just down the street. There was nothing else we could do and nothing else that they could do, except we could be there, we could abide, and we could wait for the moment where the next call could come. And the second day, there was a telephone call. But there was nothing else we could do but just to hang around. And yet they'll never... reality of the work we do and the shadows in which some you can never have a chapter about this in your book. Mm-hmm. You can never say, hey, you know, let me but there's power there. Exceptional. We had the opportunity to have George Bush people. A fascinating experience. They told me that if he got there and there was no media, he would be a completely different person, and he was. And we walked out on stage together, 2,000 people there, and he was funny, he was relaxed. Question, I said, as Mr. President, I said, the Washington Post, he said, I don't care about the Washington Post. I said, well, Mr. President, I have a really good question here. The Washington Post wrote that. He said, I don't care about the Washington Post. But the third time I asked it, I realized he was not going to answer it. And we answered that. He said, it was so fascinating. He said, you know, people think of the president as the commander-in-chief. He said, they don't know that the president is also the comforter in chief. And he said, people will never know how many times I quietly slipped out of the White House and went to Walter Reed late at night to be with the soldiers I had sent. Isn't that a wonderful image? Isn't that just fascinating? And so that's true, I think, of our leadership. There may be a sense of power. Is that other role that is extraordinarily powerful? Okay, well, let me leave those six ideas with you, and we've got about 5 minutes if you want to ask any questions or pursue any of those or make a comment about any of that, and then I'll tell you one last story. Any comments, reactions? Yes.
I just wanted to... You know, I heard this saying one time that leaders don't produce more followers, they produce more leaders. And when a leader leads in such a way that of course we can never live up to the above. We all are broken and faulty people. To show people that they can still lead even if they're limited.
His name is Dan Allender, Allender.
Thank you.
He was the president of a relatively new seminary and graduate school in Seattle. Small school, but relatively.
Lipscomb, that you had to address, and how did you rely on God to get you through that?
Well, I think for any college president, the biggest challenge is the death of a student. have to, when that happens, take a whole bunch of people through it, students, who maybe have never been through the death of someone they knew. And so it's not only the family of the student who died, it's this larger family. And my sense is it doesn't get over for weeks or months. Even that year, it probably doesn't get over. And so you move into, and then if the death is a suicide, you can multiply that tenfold. Now, you know, as I said yesterday, suicide, there will be two or three a year on one of our campuses. And so when that happens, you I was called, and the only suicide we had at Lipscomb was a young man who took his life in the dorm room. And it was about 3 in the morning, as I recall. And the circumstances all around it were horribly tragic. But as Ron and I got there, his family happened to live in town. Desperately said, how can we get the sisters before the social media? That piece of this, where you really have no time to think, no time to get your act together, you're into it, and you better know what you're doing right now. It has lots of healing moments as well. I mean, there's both of those. But a young man killed in a car accident in New Jersey where he lived, and his it was this kind of ceremonial funeral we went up and spoke at, and the young man who was just a high school football hero in town. I mean, he was a wonderful young man. And all we're all going to get through this, and they did. But we have a tradition where if a student dies, we plant a tree in their honor on the campus. And we generally do that 6 or 8 weeks later, and so we invited the family from New Jersey. They came down, and we had and all of a sudden, I see the grandfather walk away and just completely break down. Strong one through all of this. Now here's the moment. He's got to be human too, right? And so he's crying, we're crying, and he was to a school I've never heard of. But I understand. That's the hardest moment for any college president. Well, you've been wonderful. Blessings. Love, we thank you for the fact that we all gather at the foot of your cross. Allow us to see the opportunities to lead that you bring to us, whether it's formally or informally.